Let's bring in our political commentators, Neil Jones and Ben Thomas. Kia ora korua, welcome both.
Morning. Kia ora.
Neil Jones was Chief of Staff to the Labor leader Jacinda Ardern, and prior to that Chief of Staff to Andrew Little. When he was Labor leader, he's the Director of Capital Government Relations. Ben is a PR consultant and a former National Government Press Secretary. Neil has made declarations with respect to one conversation we're going to have today about climate change, that in his current role he has numerous customers with an interest, mind you. Most people have an interest in climate change policy, ranging from new technology-based style companies through to those with interest in forestry, etc. Thank you for the declaration. Look, I'm not going to start with inflation. We'll come back to it when we talk about the government's books, which came out last week. We'll talk about them as a pairing, I think. Let's just get your take on the very difficult juncture the government is at with respect to its COVID announcements and public expectations. Let's just hit on perhaps your top two or three thoughts, I think. Ben, do you want to start?
Yeah, there's two things that kind of really stand out. The first is the sort of collapsing of the government's narrative over the past, I guess, two to three weeks, you know, very suddenly. And the kind of, you know, confusion that we're seeing now, you know, it was we'd barely introduced, you know, steps one, two, and three into the alert level system. Now there's word that that's going to be scrapped for a traffic light system. And it seems the wheels have kind of fallen off in terms of that really coherent messaging that I think made it easier to follow the rules, to get public buy-in, and more importantly, from the government's point of view, to convince people that there was a plan, that there was a certain destination in mind, and that they could trust the government to take them there, which, you know, really alleviated a lot of the uncertainty. I mean, just we see it in terms of the drop in economic activity that we had when we started this latest lockdown at level four. Now, you know, of course, there were predictions of catastrophe when we went into level four last year. Here, you know, in August, people were much, much more calm about everything. There was nowhere near as much drop off, you know, even personally, you know, I didn't see any sort of impact, you know, I didn't see the same kind of impact, you know, that was sort of there, you know, last year. And I think so the unraveling of that narrative, you know, is bad from a government point of view. The other thing is, and it's related, you know, it increasingly seems like this kind of gaslighting from the government almost. You know, we're hearing that ICU is in tip-top condition, but, you know, the sector is sort of popping out of the woodwork and saying that's not true at all. We were assured, you know, since the beginning of the year that contact tracing was adequate for, I think, 3,000 cases a day. They've recently said, well, actually, we're just going to, you know, stop contact tracing a lot of these cases. And, you know, the other example, the primary one, would be the elimination strategy in general, which the government had clearly abandoned, you know, at least a couple of weeks before they admitted it. So I think there is a kind of unwinding of that trust and cohesion.
And your thoughts, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, we did have a pretty messy press conference a couple of weeks ago. I think the government has started to tell the story a bit better, but it still has a long way to go. I think it's becoming clearer that the government's view is basically that it can't eliminate Delta now, at least in Auckland, and it believes that social license to continue with hard lockdowns is ebbing away, which is why I think, you know, we saw that step system come out within level three, sort of saying if you're going to break the rules by having indoor meetings, at least do it outside, and why there's a reluctance to use level four again, because they don't believe that it's going to have the impact that it might have in the past. But look, while I've been critical of the way the government's handled this transition and approach, I think it is worth remembering that, you know, to keep a bit of perspective here, we still do have the highest levels of restrictions in the world, according to the Oxford Stringency Index, or at least among the highest. And Auckland is going to be in level three for a while longer yet. The traffic light system that was sort of came out in the media over the weekend, my understanding from people I've talked to is that is not imminent. That's something that's going to come in once we have a high level of vaccination and we're in that new world where we can manage COVID in the community. But I think there is a lot of work to be done to drive up those vaccinations. The tension the government has is how you keep people complying at least to a basic level with at level three. You know, when you have no clear idea when vaccination is going to get to the point where you can release them out. And we saw some good progress last week. I thought the mandates for education and health workers were good and bold and what was needed. And the Vaxathon Super Saturday event, again, was a big success and the kind of thing I think we needed as a country. My two things I think the government does need to do pretty urgently is, first of all, I've said this the last 2 weeks, I'm going to say it again, they need to give employers clear guidance on mandates in the workplace for vaccination. Consumers are going to demand it pretty soon. I've got unvaccinated, you know, people coming in and out of my house as I'm doing renovations. I don't want that to happen. I'm sure many people are in the same position. People in the workplace are not going to want to be exposed to people who are unvaccinated, and employers are worried about their workplace health and safety obligations. So I think the government just needs to move on that. The second, and I think the far more important, is getting that Māori vaccination rate up. I mean, we are staring down a potential disaster here if we don't get moving urgently. And, you know, some work, I do some work for a kaupapa Māori health provider. You know, I have seen firsthand how slow, bureaucratic, and disconnected the Ministry of Health can be. And I just would have thought that, you know, in a pandemic, there'd be more urgency. I mean, I look at that group in Tarawhiti who are running a Give Little page for a mobile vaccination unit. You know, they've raised 100 grand. It's an amazing thing. But we should not be relying on Give a Little to get Māori vaccinated in a pandemic. And I just think the government needs to take that approach they took during with the wage subsidy during the early stages of the pandemic and say, you know what, it might be a bit rough around the edges, but we're just going to throw money at where it's needed because, you know, if we have to open up and Māori aren't properly vaccinated, that is going to be disastrous for our social fabric as a country.
The other challenge is, and this is the real challenge they have, they've now got Auckland at 89% first vaccination, going to hit 90% this week. It's managing those expectations again. That's not double vaccination, and it's not, as you say, anything like 90% in some populations, parts of the country where you seriously need to get it there. So they're stuck in this awful are we there yet phase at a time where people are absolutely over it, even those still complying are absolutely over it. And that is one of
I think that's an important issue, is that, you know, the Australians have seen really great success by actually doing essentially what John Key kind of suggested, which is setting targets and milestones which incentivize the population. You know, you can go to the local and play two up or whatever Australians do once we hit 75%. You know, you can go to the bar yourself lurching across the floor rather than getting table service at 80%, you know, and the government's unwillingness to sort of set targets, you know, it almost goes back to their first days in office, you know, abandoning the better public service targets. And they seem very reticent to set concrete goals as a kind of incentive to people. I just also want to reinforce what Neil said. You know, the wage subsidy, the other analogue you could use would be the shovel-ready project. Billions and billions of dollars handed out on sort of, you know, kind of three-page submissions. And it seems insane. You know, Samantha Rowley did a great piece for RNZ about a meeting that Pieni Hennedy had with Māori health service providers in Northland, where they said, you know, they're having to do the same kind of level of accountability and reporting and monitoring for expenditure to fit out a vax bus that they would, you know, in normal government procurement.
Yeah, okay. Let's we need to crack on, but it's disappointing to hear that is still an issue. And it's funny, isn't it, where the public comes to the tune in a matter of hours with $100,000 to just go and get something done. Everybody really is saying, exceptional times, just get done what needs to be done as fast as possible.
I know you want to move on, Catherine, but if I could make one concrete suggestion, I think the government should take the money off the Ministry of Health, give it to TPK, and empower Pieni Hennedy and Willie Jackson and TPK to go out there and just give it to people who need it.
Okay, let's crack through some of these important next steps as in bullet point fashion. Okay, let's talk about the release this week of the draft climate proposals that came out of the government. I want to, because we haven't talked about the Greens for a while, I want to just bring that angle into your conversation as well. James Shaw's critical at the moment. He's got to answer internationally when he goes to Glasgow with New Zealand's targets, but he's also got to answer to his own party faithful What do you make of what was announced last week? Was it just simply like, we need to have a plan, so here it is? Or is there something more strategic about it? Ben?
It certainly didn't look strategic. It looked like a slightly pared down, refined version of, you know, earlier discussion documents where they just kind of group together the topics and, you know, talk about everything from obvious short-term fixes, you know, some of which are very sensible. Congestion charges, you know, should be a no-brainer. You know, they would be very useful. Even they would be a good thing for society, particularly cities like Auckland, even if climate wasn't an issue. To that sort of, you know, much more sort of blue sky thinking. You know, it doesn't give me any pointers. It is difficult because it's such a huge topic. You know, I forget who said it, but, you know, in the 80s or 90s, somebody said, you know, once, if you have a minister for the environment, eventually they will be the minister for everything. And, you know, climate change policy really is sort of heading that way. You know, we'd currently call it an all of government approach, an integrated policy approach. In the old days, it was called central planning. And, you know, this is a huge task. This is a very difficult thing for people, you know, to get their heads around, because you're looking at the whole economy, and, you know, whether you can even do that well is a big question. But look, it didn't seem to introduce, you know, too many new ideas. It seemed to just be kind of paring down and narrowing the scope of those earlier discussion documents.
Yeah, look, it was surprisingly lumpy, as James Shaw called it. There was a huge amount of detail in transport, for example. Other areas seemed pretty once over. And I thought it was quite a signal of which departments are taking climate change seriously and which weren't. James Shaw was, I think, audibly frustrated in his interviews about it. He was reluctant to criticise his colleagues, but he did sort of point to a general inertia in government. And I have to say, you know, in the work I do across the green economy space, I get a real sense there are parts of government that are moving swiftly on, you know, and quite boldly on climate change, and other parts where it's like pulling teeth. And I do think, you know, looking at that document, I would have expected better. I know it's just a draft document, but you'd expect to see the bones of a decent plan. And, you know, Jacinda Ardern called it our nuclear-free moment. She's won two elections having made a promise to act boldly on climate change. I think her ministers really need to step up and just make sure their departments are delivering on that, because as hard as it can be to turn around the ship of state and as difficult as the politics is, we're already decades behind, and the longer we leave it, the harder that transition is going to be for all of us.
There was certainly a clear difference between what was coming out of transport and what was coming out of other sectors. Now, let's look quickly at two things that I was alluding to earlier. The government's books. It was a pretty tidy set of books again last week, although the point's been made so often that these are not normal times, and you're never quite sure of what you're reading and whether it's out of date already. In fact, you can be guaranteed that it is. Let's couple that with the inflation stats that have moved further and faster than anyone was anticipating, and a nudging 5% already. A game of two halves then on the economy message, is it, Ben?
Yeah, it's a real illustration of something, you know, these kind of sort of foibles early on in this government continue to crop up as kind of themes. I think it was an interview again with RNZ that the Prime Minister confused economic indicators for the economy with the government's books and debt. You know, this was a couple of years ago. You know, just a kind of minor thing that people noted. But again, you see that, you know, the government's books look fantastic, you know, particularly in the context. At the same time, you know, we have inflation. We have, first there was inflation at a massive scale of assets, most particularly housing. That's where it really sort of starts biting, you know, ordinary people. That inflates rents. And now with consumer inflation coming through as well, you know, look, this is an inevitable side effect of pumping money into an economy where less is being produced and less is being done. I mean, you know, and the fact that, you know, Grant Robertson didn't even seem to be alive to the fact of asset inflation through government money printing last year, you know, really does show sometimes the limits of people, you know, coming through the political system who see, you know, surpluses and deficits and government accounts as synonymous with the economy.
They're not entirely unrelated. The government's books are certainly not unrelated to what's happening in the economy. And Hamish Rutherford's excellent article last week pointed out the amount of tax revenue coming through the government's books from that asset inflation. On the other side of it, as an economic manager, you do not want to see asset inflation on that scale, particularly when it's something as fundamental as housing. So, you know, as we said, if we were sitting here with a lousy set of books and inflation rising, you know what the chorus would be, Neil.
Yeah, and look, you can't disassociate the government books from the economy, because the government books are doing well because the economy is doing well. And, you know, the books are $10 billion stronger than projected. Debt's $20 billion higher, but the cost of financing that debt is lower. And I think it shows, actually, the strategy the government had of a strong health response backed by generous business support was the best strategy. And, you know, everyone who said we should have removed restrictions and let COVID in to help business, or anyone who said we should have been more worried about debt, has just been proven utterly wrong by these books.
Yeah, they came out, I think they date to just before the latest lockdown, however.
Yep, and I was going to say, I mean, it doesn't tell us what this Delta outbreak will do, but what it does tell us is that you can rebound quite quickly out of it, and that actually keeping businesses going and employees attached to those businesses means you're in good shape when you come out of that. I'd also say, you know, when it comes to debt and inflation, you know, the interest we're paying now is 0.5% of GDP. That's a third of what we were paying in interest under John Key. You know, we are in a good place, and the worst thing we could do on debt is to throttle the economy, because then, you know, how do you pay your mortgage if you lose your job, is the analogy. The other thing on inflation is we're having inflation because we have a global pandemic. You know, supply chains are stretched, the cost of materials are up, price of oil is up, we have a labor shortage. This should wash through in time. I think the worst thing we could do is panic and overcorrect, either through the government pulling back on spending or the Reserve Bank ramping up interest rates. I think, you know, we're going to hear a lot from inflation hawks, and I think we just need to stay the course. Keep an eye on inflation, but don't let us be knocked off course.
Yeah. Again, they're not unrelated, because they do have consequences on people's standards of living as well.
As long as wage growth remains high, not the end of the world.
All right. Let's finish with polls, and just help me, was there a second Courier poll that made its way into the public just recently?
Yeah.
There was certainly a Talbot Mills poll done for business clients that made its way into the public recently. And Ben, those numbers, unfortunately for Judith Collins, confirm an earlier Courier poll, do they not? How serious is this for her?
Well, now it starts to get really serious because, you know, as I was saying before, you know, the wheels almost completely fell off the government's kind of comms Rolls Royce recently, you know, during the time around the time these polls were conducted, and that National have reaped no benefit from it, seemingly, you know, is almost diabolical in terms of political management. You know, during that time, National released a very credible reopening plan, COVID response plan, and you know, the dial isn't moving. And it just suggests that, you know, the brand has been really tarnished by, you know, the antics and the performance, I think, of the leadership so far this year. On the other hand, for the centre-right, good news for ACT. David Seymour will probably be popping a bit more champagne.
ACT at about 16 and National around 22 in these polls, have I got that about right?
Yeah, in both polls about that.
And look, one thing that's really interesting about this, I think, is, you know, people talk about, well, you know, how many new ACT MPs would that be? You know, think about this large caucus. It's actually really striking to me that ACT brought in 9 new MPs, you know, one of whom was a former very close staffer, but 8 of whom were totally new to politics. And we haven't heard a peep out of them, except to, you know, usefully contribute to parliamentary debates. There have been no problems. I think that's unprecedented in terms of going from one MP to a large caucus, or, you know, mid-sized caucus, that there's just been no controversy. And I think that really speaks, you know, first of all, to the leadership, second of all, to the party whip, but really to the candidate selection. And, you know, that's something that National and Peter Goodfellow should be paying close attention to.
Neil.
Yeah, so both those polls showed ACT within 6 points of National. And what I think was particularly striking was the Courier poll had ACT ahead of National in both Auckland and rural New Zealand. And I think the more interesting one as well was Judith Collins, her favourability, her net favourability rating collapsed 20 points. She's now at minus 56. That's about as unpopular as any political leader in New Zealand has ever been. The rumour mill around her leadership, which had been kind of quietening down, is starting to wear up again. I've had a few texts this morning about, you know, is there a move on? Are people thinking about it? And I think all I'd say is that, you know, National looking at going to 2023, if you're polling like this and your leadership's this unpopular, it makes it very hard to raise money. It makes it very hard to get talented candidates. And, you know, you start to worry if you have another complete collapse in 2023, it makes the job for 26 much harder. So, you know, I think they're going to have to move on this pretty quickly.
Well, also people start looking at their own seats and thinking, where's the line drawn for me? However, like everything else at the moment, lockdown is probably impeding some decision-making or certainly some timing. So we'll wait and see what the future holds. I thank both of you very much. Neil Jones and Ben Thomas,